This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show on WCOM-LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 on your FM dial or live streaming at WCOMFM.org. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Here with Dick Paddock and our host, Lori Hoyt. Today, our special guests are John Hoyer and Mackay St. Rain.
Thank you. Iris is come in to help us with the board because Dick is going to leave us next week.
Not for good.
He's going to leave us just for a week. So we're very happy to have help and that they can come next week. I want to wish everybody a happy Veterans Day. And this is an important day that a lot of times people don't do very much about, although I did notice that PBS had some really interesting programs last night. But we are really tickled pink to have two veterans for our program today, and just feel very honored. We have
John Ewer and Makai Saint Rain. And they have come, and we're going to be talking about things that they're doing and things that they've done. So for one thing, I think you might want to just start off telling us a little bit of the history of Veterans Day and Armistice Day. I think a lot of people don't know the history in this country.
Yes, thank you, Lori and Eris. It's good to be with you today. Veterans Day started out actually as Armistice Day. November 11th, to represent the 11th second of the 11th minute of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1918, when the guns of World War I finally fell silent. Yeah. And in some places it's remembered as Remembrance Day, mm-hmm. particularly England and Ireland. Armistice Day was declared by President Woodrow Wilson and subsequent presidents and ratified by the U.S. Congress as a day to celebrate peace and good relations with all nations and all peoples. Mm. And it remained Armistice Day until 1954, when Congress changed its name from Armistice Day to Veterans Day and changed its focus from a celebration of peace to a celebration of the warrior. And we are working to reclaim the original intention of Armistice Day. So we're ringing bells on November 11th, whenever, wherever we can, around the country, around the world. We're observing in a variety of ways. We have a Swords to Plowshares Memorial Bell Tower on display that Makai helped set up last week at the North Carolina State Capitol in Raleigh.
Well, so I just wanted, for our listeners, we, I think, is an organization that both of you belong to, the Veterans for Peace.
That's
right?
Correct. Veterans for Peace was founded in 1985 and has grown to now over 100 chapters in the U.S. and worldwide. We have new chapters in London and Dublin and Vietnam, Korea. We started a new chapter in Tijuana, Mexico, that is a refuge for deported veterans, non-citizens that have served in the U.S. military that after their service, the government finds some reason to deport them to avoid having to provide them any services that they may have earned.
Oh, that's terrible.
It's a great travesty. But
it is, because I thought that when people agreed to fight for us that you got citizenship for that, but you're saying that's not happening.
That's not consistently happening by any measure, right? And Makai has some more stories about promises to service members. But
yeah.
We have four of our members, U.S. members, just visited our chapters in London and Dublin and are really boosted by the fact that this worldwide movement of veterans in solidarity is on the march.
That is such a hopeful thing. I heard a program on, I think, Diane Rehm today about another group of veterans who are trying to do community service. I think it was called, I forget the name of it.
The Mission?
Yeah.
Right.
And but Veterans for Peace is what I know about from knowing you, and that's what we're going to talk about today, Veterans for Peace. So Armistice Day, you know, everybody called that the Great War, that first war, because the slaughter was just so incredible.
The war to end all wars.
And it was the war to end all wars. And so I don't know if Armistice Day could still be the right word since it was an armistice but I guess in memory of that war was supposed to end all wars, I guess that would still make it appropriate.
Sure. And Veterans for Peace has 5 points in our mission: to educate the public on the true costs of war, to reduce and eventually eliminate nuclear weapons, to seek justice for veterans and victims of war, to restrain our government from interfering overtly or covertly in the internal affairs of other nations, and to abolish war as an instrument of national policy.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And so veterans, I mean, for other people, it just doesn't have the power then for veterans to be the ones to speak out who know intimately what war is like. And Mackay, how are you new to the Veterans for Peace?
Yes, I just joined this summer because I had never heard of them before. But
yeah.
As soon as I found out about them, I joined immediately.
So when were you in the service?
I joined the U.S. Army Reserve in 1987. And I originally signed up for 6 years, but I ended my service after 3 years.
After 3 years?
Yeah.
And were you overseas then? Or?
No, I was stationed in Savannah, Georgia. I was a combat medic. I was in ambulance unit in Savannah. And the main thing I want to say about my service is I went in specifically because I needed it and wanted a way to go to college. Okay. And I made sure I had the GI Bill. That's why I went in to get the GI Bill. And ironically, my mom told me when I went to sign up, be careful because they will try to cheat you or they'll try to promise you things that they won't give you, you know. And so I remember the day they brought in a huge stack of paper for me to sign, and they're just flipping one page after another. I think you sign about 400 things in 3 minutes. And I specifically said, I want to see my GI Bill. I want to see it here in writing. And I read that paragraph specifically, you know, to make sure I had the GI Bill. Well, I served for 3 years in Savannah, Georgia.
And that's what you signed up for?
I signed up for six, but
okay.
I had served three of those six, and my husband he wanted to move back to Indiana, so I requested a transfer back to Fort Benjamin Harrison. I was granted the transfer. I went to Fort Benjamin Harrison and started working in the Army hospital there. And about a year later, I decided to go to college. And I went to sign up for my GI Bill, and they said, oh, no, you lost that when you requested a transfer.
Oh, you are kidding.
Mm-mm.
Oh, my God.
So I fought for that, but the only concession they would give me was to say that I could go back to Savannah and finish the other 3 years that I had signed up for. Even though I was finishing the 3 years in Indianapolis, I have an honorable discharge. I was, I did everything I was supposed to do, and even had a lot of badges, and I'm a sharpshooter and all of that.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So but even though you fought it, they never restored
correct
your rights to that GI Bill.
That's right.
And I'm sure that's not an isolated case then.
Right. I asked my mom, I said, you know, when you said they would, you know, try to cheat me, who did you know or how did you know they would do that? And she said, everybody knows they will try to cheat you. But she didn't have any specific cases. But yes, we have so many stories of people in Veterans for Peace. And other, there are a lot of veterans, peace organizations, you know, Iraqi Veterans Against the War, for one, they have a lot of stories from their veterans.
So Veterans for Peace is not the only Veterans Peace Organization,
it's a
powerful one. Is it the largest one, do you think, John?
The largest and the really the only veterans organization that's dedicated to the abolition of war. We have over 100 chapters in the U.S. and worldwide. We have somewhere on the order of 4,000 members. About three-quarters of that are ex-service members, and then we have associate members who did not serve in the military but to embrace our mission statement. A lot of people don't know about us yet. Just for example, people don't know about the Combatants for Peace, former Israeli and Palestinian fighters who have come together to seek nonviolent solutions to conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And it's these kinds of efforts that tend not to get noticed, you know, as much as they might deserve.
Well, I guess it's not really a surprise that in the current climate with our media being so corporate that you don't hear things that you don't even hear the word peace. You used to hear a lot. I'm old enough to remember even politicians would dare to talk about the hopes for peace, you know. And tell me when you hear that anymore. You never hear that. It's like verboten that you would talk about peace. You know, you talk about cessation of hostilities or try, you know, mediation, some ways to kind of calm things down, but you do not hear talk of real peace.
And we were denied the right to participate in the Raleigh Veterans Day ceremonies for many years until the bankers that ran that program stepped back, and the Wake County Association of Veterans Organizations took it over, and interestingly that they were very welcoming to Veterans for Peace to participate, even reading our mission statement from their public address system as we marched by. So that's encouraging. It's, at first, peace was a dirty word. The World Peace Runners had to change their name to the World Harmony Runners because peace was basically a four-letter word. It was like somewhere between an insult and a provocation, you know, for violence. You may have seen a shirt that's been popular in recent years with the peace sign, traditional peace sign, and the phrase, backed by popular demand.
And
people are in getting to really think about ending this constant, endless violence that is just making situations worse all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe that you explicitly call for the abolishing of war, that makes it weird. They're not going to want to talk about you on the major media. So one of you talk about how we began war as a business, and I think about Eisenhower warning us. Because, you know, the fact that we have war is not just that there's bad guys out there. You always have to think about who's profiting. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things in some college course. I was so surprised. I never had thought about that. Who profits, you know? And that's a good way to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And somebody want to talk about?
And Mackay was actually studying that issue this afternoon.
Eisenhower was the first to note, and of course, I think it's very powerful that he's the one, being that he was a general. He saw the war. He was certainly no peace dove kind of person, and he warned us that, you know, that this military industrial complex was something that was new, in his view, in the American arena, starting in, well, he made that speech in 1961.
And he was a Republican. He was a retired general. Yeah. So that's what makes it so powerful, that he would speak out in spite of all these interests that would be. And I also have heard that he was going to say the military, beware of the military industrial congressional complex,
that was edited out of that speech. Right?
It was edited out about congressional, and if you noticed how strategically smart they have been, if you want to continue, that they have placed in every state weapons of war, war manufacture. We have Fort Bragg, you know, we have soldiers stationed there where they make money in the community. Every state will fight were there because they see it as an important part of their budget. We'll fight to continue money going into these war implements and people. So.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. So the war has become a major part of our economy, mm-hmm. which is a big problem, and another thing that we're calling for, a peace economy. You know, mm-hmm. we need from that time in 1961 to now, United States has become more. We are more than double. We are more than double the largest weapons manufacturer and distributor in the world. You know, the next highest country is Russia.
But that's a good point, Mackay, because not only do we go to war, we send arms with Russia used to be the worst arms dealer, but we have finally surpassed Russia, and we send arms. And now with as bad as things are in Palestine, Israel, I think that it may have been part of a deal to get Netanyahu to quiet down a little bit when we wanted the Iran deal. But we're now, I think I read that they're thinking about giving, you know, we already spend, I think, is it $3 billion a year money to Israel for its quote-unquote defense, and that I think we're going to be putting an additional huge amount of money and arms to Israel. Now, that's a great idea, isn't it? There's already so much tension there. Just incredible.
Yeah, and just one of the things I was reading today was about the defense industry mm-hmm. and where they're looking, because overall, I guess the good news is that the defense industry worldwide is projected to decline over the next few years. So that's good. But the bad news is that they're trying to figure out how to stop their businesses from declining,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so they actually have these target areas. One of them is the Middle East. And the other two main ones are India and Brazil, as places where they need to go market their defense and security services, because that's where the next market is.
That is scary.
It is.
That is very scary. And you just have to wonder, I'd love to hear more about that. Why India and Brazil? What are they anticipating there? I don't know. Wait, so that's that. Oh, that's really depressing me.
I know.
You know, we know the Mideast is already aflame, and even Republicans will admit that we started it by, started the unraveling. They had dictators there. They were bad guys, but things had a certain stability. And by going into Iraq, it's just unraveling. So ISIS is like the children of
it's
Iraq.
The swarm that came from Bush smacking the hornet's nest.
Oh boy!
Yes,
yeah, that's a good metaphor. It really is. Okay, so so right now, I think you said at the beginning, John, how we've changed from an Armistice Day thing for Veterans Day and Remembrance Day and talking about peace, that it's gotten to be honoring the soldier. And there's been so much talk in recent years about the warrior. Do you want to comment as former soldiers about this?
Well, thank you,
the
Lori. The warrior mentality has to do, in good measure, with this epidemic of veteran suicides we're experiencing now, with 22 veterans taking their own lives a day, because they're trained and told to believe that they're engaged in honorable service, but in Iraq and Afghanistan particularly, their firsthand experience is a betrayal of the government propaganda of what they're doing. They're not there to help people. They're there to control people and resources and so-called national interests. And this has a devastating effect for people that had embraced the warrior spirit, warrior mentality. And Veterans for Peace work with wounded veterans, work with moral injury, work with the hidden wounds, the post-traumatic stress, to transform that warrior spirit into peacemaking efforts.
I guess it's not surprising that some veterans then, with this warrior buildup, come back, and society doesn't need warriors. If you want to get a job, I don't think there's a jobs are looking for warrior mentality. So they're what they have prided themselves on, or what has been built up so much. I wouldn't be surprised if that's part of feeling lost when you come back. You know, your whole sense of yourself. You know, to get a job in an office when you've been a warrior. And a lot of them have had, you know, pretty interesting experience. I'm sure, you know, they've had to make decisions and do organizational stuff. I mean, this just doesn't happen.
And the Quaker House down in Fayetteville is the longest continuously operating GI rights meeting house in the U.S. And they're doing a lot of work now on the Fort Bragg base. Mm-hmm. With chaplains and social workers referring domestic violence cases, child abuse cases, which typically are epidemic in and around military bases mm-hmm. because of the anger and frustration and difficulty in adjusting from a wartime environment to stateside peacetime.
Yeah. So how, for each of you, how was... So your experience was 3 years, but were you married before you went in? Or?
Yes, I was married. My husband was also in the service.
Oh, he was too?
Yes, we were both in the Army. Or he was in the Army. I was in the Army Reserve, yeah.
Uh-huh. So that, how was the adjustment for you? Of course, you were stateside.
Yeah. So that. I was stateside. He went to Korea. Personally... I was deeply affected, I think, by my service because, mm-hmm. As you know, when I went in, I was raised in a family that my father was in the Army.
Okay.
I had both of my uncles were World War II pilots. And so I was very, very patriotic. I loved my country and I went in really wholeheartedly. I remember... standing in my uniform, so proud that I had tears brimming in my eyes because I, you know, just watching the flag and everything, I felt so consumed with passion for my country. And then, you know, I started hearing other, stories of veterans where things were, promises were not kept, things like my GI Bill. There are so many other things that are so much worse than me mm-hmm. being given my GI Bill, you know. Veterans who have really, really given a lot, even their limbs, being denied health care, mental health care. We've all heard of, you know, the homeless situation mm-hmm. on the streets. And so it kind of makes my skin crawl now when I see those commercials on TV or even people saying, you know, thank you for your service or how noble it is to serve. And then somebody serves or has their limbs blown off, we don't even remember them. They're homeless on the street. This is just a travesty, absolutely unacceptable.
It is. And you know, when they started having a volunteer army, I just thought that they would do better. You know, we're a richer country. You think you would learn from this veterans you saw suffering after the First World War, you know, but we had a depression after that. And you remember, I remember veterans' pictures sitting there trying to sell an apple, a disabled veteran. Mm-hmm. And so each war that, you know, the Vietnam War, that's where a lot of homelessness, I think, mm-hmm. started with so many veterans, and PTSD was not even, I think, recognized then. Mm-hmm. Although each war has had, they used to call it shell shock. They've had some words, but I don't think it was like a considered a medical thing that you could get benefits for. But we just don't seem to learn or want to put the money into it. It's just, I want to come back to that. We're going to take a station break now, and we can catch our breaths, and we'll make a few announcements, and then we'll come back and be talking about Veterans Day and both of you being in Veterans for Peace.
This is Wilf's Wake Up Call now on WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carver, underwritten by the Internationalist Bookstore located at 101 Lloyd Street in Carver. You can stream us live at wcomfm.org.
Thank you. And I want to make, Dick, do you want to make this
yes.
announcement?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Come over here and share a mic. First of all, I get the right thing.
While Dick is doing that, I will just say we're going to be talking about a program coming up this Sunday. And
right. That's what I have to announce here. This past summer, thousands of concerned citizens took part in one way or another in America's journey for justice from Selma, Alabama to Washington, D.C. A project of the NAACP, this historic march was a call for the passage of a new Voting Rights Act. At the head of the march was 68-year-old Middle Passage, a disabled Vietnam War veteran from Colorado who began his walk in Selma, carrying an American flag every step along the way. He died after having completed 940 miles of his journey. While Middle Passage died just short of his goal, he left a profound mark on all of us who drew strength from his courage and from his dream that one day we will, at last, see justice come to America. Middle Passage leaves behind a disabled wife in difficult circumstances. For this reason, we are hoping that you'll join us in Raleigh on Sunday, November 15th, that's this coming Sunday, from 3 to 5 p.m. at Martin Street Baptist Church, 1001 East Martin Street, Raleigh. We will be paying tribute to his determined warrior for justice and as we raise some much-needed funding for his family. So that's 3 to 5 p.m. this coming Sunday at Martin Street Baptist Church on 1001 East Martin Street in Raleigh. Food, music, and fellowship. Free will offerings accepted. Please be generous.
Okay, and to a little bit more about that, if you can't join us on the 15th, please consider making a donation online or by mail to, oh, Dick, I'm going to let you read that. I can never read these things, HT.
Okay. It's, I don't see where the address is for mail. But anyway, if you want to donate online, it's donate.naacp.org/page/contribute/honoring-middle-passage.
And maybe if you that's kind of hard to remember. This is being sponsored by the North Carolina NAACP, Reverend William J. Barber, president. So if you want to make a contribution and you didn't get that written down and you can't or couldn't find it, I think if you just click on to the NAACP and you can probably get information there or request information about that. So this was like very, very sad that he was carrying the flag. One of our WILF members, Ruth South, was marching with him right at that time. And so she's going to be there this Sunday and other people who were on that march. So this would be a wonderful thing to go to, Martin Street Baptist Church, 1001 East Martin Street, Raleigh, 3 to 5. So if you can go, go, and if you can't, please think about making a contribution for this disabled wife that he left at home, but who was urging him to do this if he needed and wanted to do it, which he did. And so it's just like a veteran. He sort of died while not fighting for his country, but struggling for justice for people in this country who need justice. And that's very moving. Yeah. So this is Wolf's Wake Up Call. We're on every Wednesday. I'm Lori Hoy. Dick Paddock just read the announcement. Iris is Schwitzer is doing the board, and our guests are John Ewer and Makai St. Rain, and we're talking. They're both veterans. We're here honoring Veterans Day, and talking about how we can work towards maybe not having more veterans, how we can work towards abolishing war. And you know, it's gotten to be a foreign concept, but after the First World War, it wasn't. Everybody talked about that. They called it the Great War. It was going to be the war to end all wars because people were so horrified by the carnage of thousands of young and old men, women, and children, collateral damage, you know, slaughtered in the fields of France and Germany. And we got in kind of late in that war because their people at that time in our country did not want war. The mood of the country was very against it. And so, but they, the war was going so badly that we, and I think Wilson had campaigned on not us going to war, but then he did send it that last year. And even though it was not that long a period of time, we lost, I don't know how many, but many, 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 many thousands of people.
I think I read over 53,000. I'm pretty sure that's the number I read this morning.
Well, with just a little over a year, I think, that we were actually in that war. And so that began Armistice Day, which then got, instead of celebrating peace, we got into glorifying war and start calling it Veterans Day, and with the idea, sort of this myth that we're honoring veterans. But if we truly honored them, I want to get back to what we were talking about with Makai and with John, how if we really honored them, why are we not having sufficient money to take care of them when they come home? Why is there continuing scandal about shortchanging our veterans' hospitals, shortchanging our veterans, and also breaking promises like the GI Bill? And so many I've heard with these brain injuries that they will misdiagnose as a way to not have to pay benefits. And some, and way too many, this is not isolated cases. It's been, that has been on TV, how so many of veterans are having to fight month after month to prove that they deserved to get medical help. You know, they have to find where they were at a certain time, even though they were moved around from hither to there, you know, hither or thither around the Afghan or the Iraq countryside. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely scandalous. And we look at, you know, you see people homeless. I see them sometimes up on the highway. You know, I'm a veteran. I'm looking for a job, or I need food. So, okay. So this is all the sad stuff we've been talking about. So, what you guys are working with Veterans for Peace, trying to get the word out. So we're trying to win against this military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about. Give us some help about what are some things we can all do.
Well, I think that we do have to realize that it is a military-industrial complex, and it does, and now, 50 years later, it has completely infiltrated our Congress. There's a revolving door going between Congress and defense contractors in the Pentagon.
Yes.
People, and it has become such a big business that it's I kind of think of it as the other, like, 1%, in the sense that our military budget is so huge that we don't have the money for veterans. You know, we have spent so much money on military weapons and having the, by far, more than double the biggest military of any nation in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could defend ourselves against many attacks. Like, if the entire world attacked us all at once, we would be fine. You know, and that's not going to happen. So why do we have all of these weapons?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that this is it really plays up and shows that the myth of what this is it's not that it's that our veterans are committing suicide, because when they get there, unfortunately, the balloon, you know, is popped, the mm-hmm. Delusion is popped, mm-hmm. and they suddenly realize that they are caught up in not something that's helping somebody, not mm-hmm. helping the Afghan or mm-hmm. Iraqi people, but instead claiming territory for more oil mm-hmm. and power mm-hmm. in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And that's devastating, you know. It's devastating to people. So
because they started out like you, very patriotic,
yes, exactly.
You know, and feeling proud of themselves, and then when you get to realize the mendacity, you're just there for the oil companies that that you
yes,
know.
And especially in these wars, Afghanistan and Iraq right now, the enemy is very nebulous. We don't really know who it is, and we've seen story after story of veterans who come back and say, you know, we burst into somebody's living room, and the wife and husband and the kids were sitting there, and they're waving their guns around because maybe the husband is a terrorist. But you know, the intelligence isn't always good, and the situations are not clear cut. And then our warriors, you know, end up sometimes killing people that they're not sure if those people were actually terrorists or involved at all, you know. So that's a horrific thing to realize, that you went in really hoping that you were going to help somebody, and in fact you've killed somebody that you will have to live with that memory for the rest of your life, and also the memory of really never knowing, was that person actually a combatant or an enemy?
Well, you know, you just put your finger on something that I think is also important. In the First World War, the armies fought each other. There may be, I use the word collateral, which I hate that word, but, you know, civilians got killed, got in the way, or it was their village or whatever. But that was not that's not who you were fighting. You knew who you were fighting. It was these other soldiers in uniform. And now, to go and you're bursting into people's living room and frightening little kids and the mother, you know, because it's amorphous. Where is that enemy? It's not like we're having armies fighting on a battlefield, or very little of that. An awful lot of that is the uncertainty of what you're doing and who you're doing it to. Right. And that, I think, would be a big part of coming back with a lot of moral, like really your soul being hurt and wounded by all of that. Yeah. Exactly.
And Lori, one of our challenges is to come to believe that peace is actually possible. And there are a lot of people that just flat out do not believe it. Even folks in the peace movement. Sometimes, you know, they work for peace, but they don't even believe in their own hearts
and
consciousness
hearts.
That it's possible. And part of the reason I say that is because this was part of Mackay's mission before she even learned about Veterans for Peace. She was on her own Peace is Possible mission.
That's how you two met?
Well, that's when I learned about Mackay's mission. She joined Sam Winstead's Ride for Peace on the first day back on May 9th, and rode the first day with Sam Winstead, a 90-year-old Marine veteran who's launched an annual bicycle ride for peace, 350 miles from Raleigh to Washington, D.C., just finished his fourth ride this May. 1 week later, on May 17th, Mackay launched her own Peace is Possible ride from here to Indianapolis, Indiana, where her grandchildren live.
So Mackay is going to sing us a song?
Yeah.
And then don't let me forget, while you're still here, I want to hear about the peace boat.
Yes.
We almost forgot that. Okay. So what is this song? This is
So this is a song I just wrote as John, so did a pretty good introduction. I did a peace ride this summer, and I call it
that was with the bike?
Yes, a bicycle. I rode my bicycle from here, started at the Oasis here in Carrboro, and rode to Bloomington, Indiana. And just as because I am so upset, I'm passionate about standing up and having America be educated as to what we are doing in the world, it's hard to get information sometimes in the corporate.
Yes, it's hard to get it out. We keep trying, but yes.
Yeah, but you have to look for it. So, so this was my effort at getting the word out, and then I wrote this song. It's called "Peace Is Possible." Did you ever ache for peace on this beautiful earth we call home? I've often wondered how it could be,
if our soldiers did not roam? What if we settled our differences with true democracy and finally used our wisdom to lead the world to see peace is possible, peace is possible. I can see it, I can feel it, I know we can find a way. Peace is possible, peace is possible. We have everything we need right now, and today is a brand new I just can't think of anything as important to understand, that one creator made us all with a loving hand. How beautiful to see us all yearning for that place where we know we are one. And finally, we'll respect one another as our Creator has done. Peace is possible. Peace is possible. I can see it, I can feel it. I know we can find a way. We have everything we need right now, and today is a brand new day. We have everything we need right now, and today is a brand new day.
Oh, that was beautiful, Makai. That's Makai St. Rain, a veteran, a grandmother of six, and another one on the way, and a musician and a composer. All the many ways that you are a gift to our world, you really are.
Thank you.
And so this is so beautiful. I mean, and that's what we've got to keep our focus on if we want to get out of this culture of killing, culture of brutality. You know, when you look at gun control, you look at violence in our society, and we are a violent society. Going to war so much, I think, is a big contributor to what happens. Mm-hmm. It's another mirror, a reflection of all of that.
Lori, I'd like to add at this point the violence right here in Chapel Hill. The murder of three Syrian students earlier this year led to Ahmed Salim, our friend and producer-director of Films for Rural Peace, becoming a friend with Faris Barakat, who is the brother of the slain student and mm-hmm. his wife and sister. And Ahmed was inspired because Faris Barakat, the brother, offered forgiveness rather than retribution to the perpetrators of the murders of his brother, sister, and sister-in-law. And this is the World Peace Challenge that Ahmed composed as a result of that experience. I aspire to transform conflict into discovery without aggression and to seek environmental, economic, and social justice through peaceful means. I challenge myself not to fight fire with fire and to respond to anger and greed with wisdom, to cultivate harmony within my person, my home, and my community, to stand against all forms of oppression while not oppressing, to support those who are nonviolent and to defend myself and others against physical violence, to attack problems, not people, cultures, religions, classes, genders, or races, to honor my positive values and needs and not seek gain from another's loss, to neither reject sincere efforts at reconciliation nor impose solutions on others, to acknowledge the potential of all people as equal co-creators of positive change.
Oh, that is beautiful. We're just listening to John Ewer reading. This was the
World Peace Challenge, written by Ahmed Salim, who is producer and director of Films for World Peace.
Oh, that was by Ahmed.
This is by Ahmed and Salim. And Ahmed has become a partner with Sam Winstead's Ride for Peace. They've been working together now for the last couple of years and have big plans for growing this ride in the future.
So how old is Sam now?
Sam was 90 on May 22nd.
And he, just in this past year, he did another ride.
He completed his fourth Ride for Peace.
It's his fourth?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
He rode 350 miles from Raleigh to Washington, D.C., which he has done every year for the last 4 years. And then after that, because we had just met each other, as you and as John had just told you, I started my ride a week later, and I ended up in California, riding down the coast of California as the second half of the Peace Is Possible bike tour. And I invited Sam to come out with me, and he joined me in Los Angeles and rode the last 150 miles to the Veterans for Peace conference. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing, both of you. And so is that where you... There was a peace boat. I don't want to let you go without hearing a little bit about the peace boat.
Yeah.
We're okay.
So I learned about the Golden Rule peace boat through the Veterans for Peace. I just found out about veterans Veterans for Peace through these the rides. I was doing my ride, and then I heard about Sam doing his ride, and that was connected to Veterans for Peace. So once I arrived in Indiana, I said, well, let's find out about this organization. And I went on their website, and I found out that they were about to launch a project they had been working on for 5 years, which was the Golden Rule Peace Boat. The Golden Rule was a little 30-foot sailboat. It was built in 1958 and bought by four Quaker men with the intention of sailing it out into the Pacific Ocean, into the Marshall Island test zone where the United States was carrying out atmospheric nuclear testing. And... They set sail, and they were actually arrested in Honolulu before they could get to the test zone. But ironically, there was a scientist who was a researcher for the United States Atomic Commission. And he had been doing tests on, or, you know, he had been monitoring Japanese children for 5 years on the effects of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, mainly Hiroshima. And he was completely horrified by what he was finding out, was ongoing birth defects and, women who were having children, you know, even years later after the war, having birth defects and the children being stunted in their growth and not able to absorb nutrients, and just it was really horrific. When the men of the Golden Rule were arrested, Dr. Reynolds happened to be in the port with his own family and took up the mantle, and he and his family went and made it into the nuclear test zone.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
What a story.
Yeah.
What a story.
Quite a story. And because of that, publicity that those things, those actions garnered, resulted in the first nuclear test ban treaty, which I think was 1961 or 1963. And the other thing is that it inspired Greenpeace.
After that action, there was a woman who, you know, had heard of that action, and she went back to this other group in the Pacific Northwest and said, "Hey, let's get a boat," and and that became Greenpeace.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's wow. Yeah. So you found out this story through
The website. So the Golden Rule had done this, you know, magnificent action in 1958, and immediately after the men were arrested, they just sold the boat, because that was their whole purpose, was really to get arrested and to get, you know, some publicity for the fact that we were doing this stratospheric nuclear testing, which is very dangerous. And they were finding radiation in milk, even in mother's milk and cow's milk, you know. So they sold the Golden Rule, and it went off into private hands. And in 2010, it was sunk by accident on Humboldt Bay, in Northern California, and Veterans for Peace found out about it and raised it. And so from 2010 until this last June, we're completely refurbishing this sailboat.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So when I heard about it in June, they were about 6 weeks away from launch and desperate for carpenters and sailors and volunteers. And here I was on this bike ride for peace. And I had kind of wanted to end my bike ride at the Veterans for Peace conference, but I hadn't figured out how I was going to get across the desert. I really wasn't.
Where was the conference at?
In San Diego.
Okay.
Yeah. So so this solved my problem. You know, I was able to fly to Eureka, California, and work on the boat for 6 weeks until she set sail, and then I continued my bike journey down the coast of California, and I talked about the Golden Rule all the way. And
so in that bike journey, were you by yourself?
I was by myself for about half of it. From San Francisco to Los Angeles, I was by myself, and then Sam Winstead came out and joined me for the last 150 miles down.
That is so incredibly brave. I just can't imagine. Oh my gosh. So what were you, when you're trundling along on your bicycle, what do you have, like a flag or a placard? Or how do people know what you're doing?
Yes. I had a flag, and I had brochures and things I was handing out, and I was speaking at dinners and churches and for groups, you know, as much as I could along the way.
I think we're going to be almost running. Oh, gosh, I just wish we could keep going. I'd like you to play another song. You're going to have to come back sometime. That was absolutely wonderful. Thank you both. We've had John Ewer and Makai St. Rain, who are both veterans. We've been talking about what it means to be a veteran, how it's changed how we look at that, what we think about Armistice Day, what we think about peace. And they're both with Veterans for Peace and trying to educate and help us all understand that we need to abolish war and that we literally can have peace. If enough of us can really want it and get in that struggle, you know, if all the